Hello and welcome back to The Garden Podcast. I'm Chris Young, editor of The Garden Magazine, the monthly magazine for RHS members. This podcast is all about the stories behind the stories that we cover in our pages. It's a chance to explore issues that interest and inspire us, and to hear directly from those steeped in gardening expertise, whether it be plants, people, designers, nurseries, or horticultural legends. Today, it's Christmas, as Noddy Holder is so fond of crying in the seasonal soundtracks that we hear all the time. It is not, of course, Christmas just yet, but the December edition of the magazine will be dropping through your letterbox any day now and has a truly festive flavour, including a really fun and inspiring piece by garden writer Sue Stickland all about how to grow your own Christmas dinner. I spoke to her to see what she's going to be serving up. Sue, for those people who've been reading The Garden magazine for some years now, they'll know that your knowledge and passion for growing your own is second to none. In fact, you've just written about shallots in our November issue as well. And it's great that in this magazine, you've written an article all about growing veg for the Christmas dinner. So tell me, have you been growing veg for Christmas for many years?
Oh, certainly. I can't remember how long ago it was that I actually started growing veg, but I think for the last 10 years or so where we've been settled in and going to friends for Christmas dinner and that sort of thing, that it's become a definite thing.
And has that been a conscious decision, or is that just because you're growing so much fruit and veg generally through the year, or was there a moment in time a few years ago when you thought, actually, I want to be able to supply the table with the veg that it needs?
I actually try and be as self-sufficient in vegetables all year round as we can. So it's more that, really. But I always have Christmas in the back of my mind, you know, when I'm ordering seeds or planting out or whatever.
Fabulous. Because as your article implies, a lot of this is about the planning, isn't it? So what's the one thing that people should think about when they're planning their vegetable spread?
I think people forget how important cultivar is, really, when you're choosing your seeds. One thing people don't realise is perhaps that crops such as carrots are described as early, but that really just means they're quick to mature. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to sow them in spring. So early crops are often the best for sowing later in the year as well, because they grow quicker, they're quicker to mature. So cultivar can be very important.
So back in the article, you focus on some of the key crops: carrots, potatoes, Brussels sprouts, parsnips. So what are you, some of your favourite selections or cultivars of those? And why particularly do you think they're good for Christmas dinner?
Well, sprouts is the obvious one. It's something that some people eat just at Christmas time, isn't it? But actually, yeah. I love Brussels sprouts.
So you don't have to.
And certainly, that's where I'm not a great fan always of F1 hybrids, but that's when I would always choose an F1 hybrid. And there has been some very good breeding work on making sprouts sweeter.
And is that what the F1 Vigor does? Is it vigor or is it flavour or is it a bit of both?
It's certainly not flavour, but if you've only got a small garden and you want every plant to be good because they take up quite a lot of space, then I would say that at the moment the F1 hybrids are the better for Brussels sprouts, not for other things. And also they form all up the stem. So if it's really cold and you wanted to do it like you see in the shops, cut the whole stem and take it into the shed or into the conservatory to pick off your sprouts. You know, that can happen at Christmas, can't it? If it's very cold and frozen, the last thing you want to be doing is standing outside with freezing fingers picking off individual Brussels sprouts.
What about parsnips? Because I love parsnips and I love them fresh from the garden, and especially when they're glazed with a bit of honey or something. It's one of my favourite vegetables. Which cultivars do you grow the most?
I just usually grow a fairly old variety, Tender and True, or something like that. I honestly don't think there's a lot of difference in flavour between parsnip cultivars. I don't know whether you agree. I mean, as you say, you don't often serve naked boiled parsnip, do you? They're usually roasted.
They're embellished or something.
Yeah,
aren't they?
Embellished.
And so when we look at the range of vegetables in the article, potatoes, carrots, cabbage, parsnips, Brussels sprouts and leeks, can you treat all of those equally? by which I mean, can you leave them all into the ground and actually harvest them when you want nearer Christmas, or do some need to come into the house first because of the risk of frost?
Well, parsnips are definitely very hardy. They can always stay in the ground. The only risk is that the ground will be frozen on Christmas morning or Christmas Eve when you want to go and harvest them. So if that looks like happening, I cover a part of the bed with straw or old leaves or something like that, so you can definitely get them up.
And what about leeks and carrots and potatoes? What's your best advice for those?
With potatoes, we're talking about varieties that you can grow in the autumn, what they call second crop potatoes, and the tops of those will be taken by the frost. I would only ever grow those in a pot.
So the potato can stay in the ground, but you keep that pot frost-free until
yes,
you actually need the potatoes.
That's right, yeah.
And what about carrots and leeks?
Well, leeks, this is a cultivar thing again. What is described as an early leek might not be frost-hardy. I mean, we very rarely get that hard a frost before Christmas. But the mid-season and winter leeks, they're usually described like that. They're always hardy. The only difficulty, again, is if we got a very hard frost and you wouldn't be able to get them out of the ground very easily.
Hmm. One of the things I really enjoyed about the article was the way you opened our eyes to winter salads. And you actually say, forget trying to grow lettuce. There are alternate salad leaves that are as much hardier, healthier and easier to grow. So what are they, Sue? And what should we consider if we want some greenery and some leaf at Christmas time?
Well, I'm lucky that I've got a polytunnel. And nearly a third of my polytunnel is just full of about 9 different types of oriental green and 4 different types of chicory. We just love having winter salads. But even if you haven't got a polytunnel, you can grow. I think the best thing to start with is what they call a salad mixture, oriental mixture. And you can grow those perhaps in pots that you've had tomatoes in or grow bags that you've had tomatoes in and sow them in September, and in a greenhouse, then you'll get fresh leaves.
And there's some really good mixes available now, aren't there, where you just sow direct. And as you say, you can actually use spent compost in a pot or something from earlier in the season, and they grow absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, I think everybody should give that a try. But if you can't, outside there's lamb's lettuce or land cress. They're both very hardy, and Claytonia is very hardy. But if you can cover those with a cloche, it helps keep them clean, a bit cleaner and a bit fresher to crop.
Look, Sue, thank you very much. It's always lovely having you in the magazine and learning from your knowledge. So thank you for that. And can I be the first to wish you a very happy Christmas this year?
Thank you very much, Chris.
Sue Stickland. You can read Sue's fascinating article, which is full of practical tips for vegetable growing and some mouth-watering but simple recipes, in the December issue of The Garden. If you're an RHS member, you'll know that the magazine is delivered direct to you for free every month. And if you're not a member yet, why not? Come along and join us. The benefits include unlimited free entry to our 4, soon to be 5, RHS gardens, along with priority booking and discounted entry to RHS events and shows. There are links to more information on our programme page at rhs.org.uk/thegardenpodcast. I'm currently checking the final pages and proofs of the December issue. And as editor, I really enjoy this bit because it gives me a chance to reflect on what we're publishing and just double check that everything is how we want to present it and how it's coming across on page. And December issue is full of information, and we really try to be really strong on seasonality this month. We've got a great piece all about ornamental brambles, so the family of rubus. So we think of brambles, or I certainly do in my garden, of these things lurching through the trees and taking over the land. But actually, there are a lot of brambles that you can use ornamentally. They have beautiful winter stems, and also some of them have some great summer foliage. And so Barry Clark, who is an expert on rubus, on brambles, takes us through some of the best ones for winter, but also the ones which have got great winter stem interest, but also that leaf through the summer that really makes them an all-round year plant. Some of them can be pretty tough and pretty invasive, and you've got to control them. But the more you look after them, the more you cut them down each year, then they throw these new shoots up happen. Some of the stems are really picturesque, especially on a cold winter's morning. So it's a great piece for that. One of the things which we are always struggling on the magazine is to get the right amount of snow. When you're looking at a garden feature set, the photographers get up early at 5 o'clock in the morning and are taking photos of these beautiful gardens. And if there's too much snow, you don't really see anything. You just see a lot of white. If there's not quite enough snow, the garden can look a bit empty. So we are quite strict about our levels of snowness when we're doing a garden feature. And this piece this month about Velly Priory has got just the right amount of snow so that you can see the edges of the clipped topiary, you can see the formal lawns, you can see the views out to the landscape. But it gives you enough of that cold, beautiful, frosty morning feel. But there's enough horticulture and splendour in it that actually makes it appropriate for the magazine. So that's a really great 6-page feature all about this garden shining in the middle of winter. I don't know about you, but in the winter, I often don't feel I'm in the garden enough because it's either too wet or rainy or windy or whatever. But pruning apple trees is something I always do when I'm off over the Christmas time. You can prune apple trees through the winter, and actually it's such a good time to do it, especially if it's a cold day. You might want to be leaving your family indoors if they've been causing you a little bit of headache or you feel like you've eaten too much. And getting outside and shaping and bringing some air to your apple trees is so important. There's the old saying about being able to throw a bowler hat through the centre of an apple tree to make it airy enough and let the air get through it. So I love pruning apple trees. I'm also incredibly obsessive about keeping bits of wood for the fire. So as soon as I do any pruning, I then snip them up into a bag and let them dry for kindling for next year. But pruning, shaping apple trees is a really good thing to do in the winter. Gets you outside. It's when the tree wants and needs to be pruned. And there's a practical 4-page feature with step-by-step illustrations on how to do it. And for anybody who's been thinking about apple tree pruning over the years, we used to talk about tip and spur-bearing plants. We don't do that now. You can just get out, relax, not worry too much about what your apple tree is and get pruning. So there's some really useful updated advice all about apple trees. One important change we've made to the magazine this year was in the way it was dispatched. We introduced plastic-free packaging to send the magazine to members. In so doing, we've actually taken out 5 million plastic bags out of circulation. So we're really proud of this, and it's something that we've been championing for a long time. The harm plastic packaging can do to the environment and the need to reduce our use and reliance on plastics, particularly single-use items such as magazine wrappers, is one of the most hotly discussed issues around the globe right now. Our columnist, Sally Nex, has been writing a regular feature charting her personal challenge to reduce her use of plastics in the garden. She concludes and reflects on her journey in December's issue. I spoke to her all about it and what she's found out. Sally, it seems a long time ago now, doesn't it, since when we were discussing over a lunch back in summer 2017, all about your regular column focusing on going plastic free. So give us the headline. How has the world changed in that time, and how has that last year or two gone for you?
Oh, well, it has been a couple of years of discovery, I have to say. I've sometimes felt like I'm caught up in this massive scientific experiment. It's extraordinary. I've had a lot of fun kind of exploring all the different alternatives. And also, it's just got me talking about it to all sorts of different people, just anybody that I run across, and of course, people who've contacted me through reading the column and so on and so forth. I think that people are much more aware of the whole subject now. And there are lots of sort of hidden uses of plastic, which seem to be emerging all the time. I mean, I didn't really realize until recently, for example, that there's plastic mesh in turf. Turf is rooted into plastic mesh. And of course, when you put that in the garden, that deteriorates underneath the ground. There's been a lot of stuff on social media just recently about that. And artificial lawns as well, sadly getting, it seems, increasingly popular. But there's a bit of a backlash against that. People are really aware of it now. And there have been some wonderful new initiatives that have come through. I mean, the most promising in my book is that Melcourt, who are the peat-free compost makers, have started to offer garden centres the use of refillable compost bags for life, which you can refill, take home, bring back, get them to fill it up again. Absolutely brilliant. And it's peat-free too.
You've done 10 columns for us now, and the December issue is really a reflective piece, isn't it, on what you've learned. What would you say are the 4 or 5 quick wins that people can do at home to reduce plastic use?
Oh, well, the first thing that I think you can do is simply to pledge to buy no new plastic, which is a very simple sort of mental change, really. It means that whenever you go shopping for your garden, whenever you walk into a garden centre, automatically you're looking for alternatives. So when you reach out to buy a new watering can, you'll pick up the galvanized one, not the plastic one. When you're buying plant labels, you reach out for the bamboo ones rather than the plastic ones. Those kind of choices make all the difference in terms of just reducing the amount of plastic that you bring into your garden. Connected with that, number two, is be careful how you buy your plants, because that is one of the most prolific ways that plastic re-enters your garden, even when you're trying to get rid of the stuff. Because, of course, every plant you buy comes with a plastic pot.
Yeah, or a plastic
and they
label.
Heap up in their hundreds all over the garden. So rather than that, just buy bare root. They're on sale now, and there's an increasing choice, and lots of suppliers do them, so it's really not hard to find them. Even perennials and that kind of thing. I'm not just talking about roses and wallflowers.
Yeah.
And the obvious things here, you know, nearly every plant that you can think of, you can buy bare root these days. Or, of course, you can raise them yourself from cuttings and seed and that kind of thing. It's great fun to do that, too. A third thing, you can also simply start making newspaper pots for your seedlings and for pricking out and that kind of thing, so that you don't need to use plastic modules anymore. That's a very straightforward thing to do, that you can just pick the newspaper out of your recycling box and do. And also, getting used to making your own potting compost is a really fantastic way of stopping plastic bags coming in through the gate on your compost that you're buying in. Build yourself an extra compost bin. You may well need it in this case. But more composting is also a very good thing to do. And you mix that in with topsoil and that kind of thing to make really lovely multi-purpose potting compost, just like you'd buy from the garden centre. But of course, you save yourself money as well as going plastic free.
But tell me, you know, obviously you've got the column and, you know, the magazine goes to 500,000 members each month. But have you had lots of feedback? Have you had lots of feedback about the column on social media? What have people been saying?
Oh, I've had more response to this than nearly anything that I've written. I've been getting letters through the post. It's wonderful. People send me adaptations of their own version of loo roll planters when you can, and stuff like that. And I've had lots of suggestions. People telling me off for wearing fleeces in the pictures, which I completely take on board. That's a bit of a dilemma for me, because I know that when you wash them, you put plastic fragments into the environment. But on the other hand, I don't really want to throw them away either, because, of course, that's environmentally problematic too. Anyway, that's diversion. That's a big diversion there. But people have been getting in touch on Twitter. People have sent me lots of suggestions. Somebody came up with a new brand of convenience food that is sold in Tesco, which is sold in bamboo trays, which you can then reuse for seedlings.
It's just wonderful, the stuff
that people have come up with. It's just inspiring.
I mean, I certainly feel that from our point of view. You know, we have obviously columns every month, and we've had them for years, and we've got some of the, what we like to think is the best writers in the industry. But it has been really interesting getting these 10 consistent series for you, and you really writing from a personal position and a personal journey. And it really does seem to have reacted well with people.
Yes, I mean, I think I felt all the way through writing this, I'm not aware of anybody writing about this in this kind of depth before anywhere else. And I have really, in my own very, very humble way, felt like I'm breaking new ground with this stuff and doing my own experiments and finding out for myself, which is, of course, the best kind of scientific way of doing it. Well, it's kind of quasi-scientific, I suppose. But it has felt, I've got really fired up about it, and I've found it really, just really exciting, the whole thing. I've just really enjoyed it.
One of the things that we never wanted the column to do was to be too preachy, did we? We wanted it to be honest, your sort of journey in understanding this and actually engaging with people about it. One of the questions for me really is, have you managed to become 100% plastic free, or are you taking quite a sort of balanced view on it? The things like hoses or water butts, they're thick plastic, they're going to last 15, 20 years or whatever, and that's actually okay?
Yes, it's absolutely okay. I mean, I take a really kind of relaxed point of view about this. My garden is still full of plastic and probably always will be, partly because I am reusing the plastic that I've already got, which is a good way of keeping it out of landfill. But also because, you know, as you say, quite a lot of the plastic that I already had in my garden, things like watering cans and hose pipes and that kind of stuff, it's all perfectly good, and there's no point in throwing serviceable plastic items into landfill because you've got some grandiose principle. I think that just a relaxed kind of attitude towards it, and as I was saying earlier, just that kind of mindset. At the moment, we all think of plastic as a default. You know, whenever you kind of reach out for something that's new for the garden, you choose plastic, or, you know, you choose a plant in a plastic pot because that's more convenient, more available, all those kinds of things. Rather than having plastic as the default, I think we should have biodegradable as the default. And if that doesn't work as well as plastic, choose plastic. By all means, it's a really useful material.
And it's done us pretty well in the industry, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems, with pots accepted, the rest of it is designed for using in the garden. I mean, who could think of a better material than plastic for example, watering your plants? It's waterproof. It lasts for ages. What's the problem there? It depends really how purist you want to be. Yes, you can jettison your hose pipe when it starts leaking a bit too much and you can't keep repairing it and you do have to chuck it out. Rather than buying another hose pipe, you can be very purist about it and simply decide to water with your galvanised watering can instead. That's fine if you've got a small garden, not so great if you've got a larger garden, especially with the droughts we're getting in the summer. So, you know, it's about what you're prepared to do. And I think the most important thing is that everybody does something, however small. If everyone does something, we can make a real, real difference to the amount of plastic that's going into the wider environment. And part of that, as I say, it's just a psychological thing, just a mindset. You know, I think that if we all did a little bit, then we'd get a long way.
Fabulous. Can't wait to read it. Thank you, as ever, for your time, Sally. You can read Sally's article in December's magazine and catch up with more of her journey in the earlier issues, which started back in March. Finally, it wouldn't really seem like Christmas without a tree. And for me, like so many of us, it has to be a real tree. Simon Maughan, who is a Christmas tree grower and also one of the RHS Books editors, has written a fascinating guide to how trees are grown and harvested and the different types of trees available. In fact, we've got one of our photographic plates which shows 10 different types of trees you could use as a Christmas tree. He considers the benefits of different varieties and whether they're sourced from the UK abroad or how they are grown in containers or not. We ask Simon for some expert advice.
If you're buying a Christmas tree in December, the best time depends on what type of Christmas tree you're buying. If you're buying a non-drop tree, which is the Nordman fir, first week of December is fine for them because they last really well. If you're buying a Norwegian spruce tree, which is the traditional Christmas tree, it's best to wait as long as possible from cutting. So if you can cut fresh, the better. That tree would last about 3 weeks indoors if it's kept watered, after which time it will begin to drop its needles. If you want to get the best out of your Christmas tree, the best thing to do is probably keep it watered. And you don't need to cut a bit off the bottom of the stem like is commonly believed. I don't think that's true anymore. The British Christmas Tree Growers Association have conducted tests in that regard, and I found it doesn't make any difference. But what does make a huge difference is keeping the tree watered. So if you can buy a stand that will take water, once you've bought your tree, you can put it in a stand and then you can put water in the bottom and keep it topped up, because the freshly cut Christmas tree, once it's brought into the house, will suddenly drink quite a lot of water. So you might find you need to top up that water level probably every morning or evening with about half a pint of water, depending on how much your stand will take. Don't put it in a really hot room. It will dry out more quickly. It's common sense, really. And if you're buying a tree growing in a pot, then obviously keep it watered because it will stay alive. And as long as it's alive, it will carry on looking good. So my favourite type of Christmas tree are the spruces. These are the traditional trees. From a grower's perspective, I like them because they're quite straightforward to grow. They grow quite quickly. They're very responsive to pruning. They make a really nice shape. They have the traditional smell of Christmas trees. The branches are spaced well, which are great for hanging decorations on. And also there are different types of spruce. As well as the traditional Norwegian, I grow the Serbian spruce as well. And also there's the blue spruce. If I was to plant a Christmas tree in the garden, if I had a small garden, I probably wouldn't plant a Christmas tree at all because they can get quite big. I mean, after all, they are forest trees. But the Nordman fir looks great. Any of the firs, actually, because they've got a lovely thick, dark green needle. Makes a lovely contrast to other plants in the garden. They've got a lovely shape and branch structure. And they're good evergreens, but they do get big. If you've got more space, you can plant spruces, which also look good, and especially planted in the distance where they could be observed from the house. They make really beautiful trees. Something I encourage people to do sometimes, especially if they're buying a tree that's grown in a pot, Christmas trees that are grown in their pots, just make sure that they are actually pot growing when you buy them. The easy way to tell is have a look to see if it's got roots on the end of the trunk. And if you're buying one of those each year, you can plant one each year, and gradually you'll have your own little plantation going. Once a tree starts to outgrow its situation in the garden, and you've kept it well clipped, and there's no reason why you shouldn't chop that tree down and bring it into the house and have your own Christmas tree. I think that'd be a rather neat idea. Apart from buying a Christmas tree from me, of course, if you are buying a tree this year, try and buy from a local grower, because you're going to end up with a fresher tree. Trees that are grown abroad and brought in are cut early. In fact, I expect that cut trees are already coming into this country now in mid-November, whereas a local grower wouldn't even be thinking about cutting yet. They'll probably maybe waiting a couple of weeks. And although it sounds obvious, a tree that's cut early is simply not going to last very long once you bring it into the house, because it's once you bring it into the house that's when it starts to dry out. Another thing is people often have greedy eyes, I think, when they're buying a Christmas tree, and they tend to buy a tree that's too big for their room. So take a measuring stick with you, or a measuring tape. Make sure it's the right size, because there's no point buying a big tree and spending loads of money on it only to find that it's chopped the top off to fit it in the room. Another thing I like to do is give the tree the hug test, and that is put your arms around the tree. And if your arms can go around the tree, it's probably not going to take up too much space in the living room. If you can get your arms around it, it's going to be quite a wide tree, and it might end up being a bit of an obstacle during Christmas, and everyone will start cursing the Christmas tree. If you're walking around the Bristol area, you'll probably see lots of people hugging Christmas trees. This is not because they're all tree huggers, that's because they're doing the Christmas tree hug test. If you're looking to buy a pot-grown Christmas tree, this is a really good idea, because you can grow the Christmas tree on. It's quite an environmentally sound way to buy your Christmas tree. However, if you're looking to buy one of these, there's one important thing you've got to look out for, and that's to be able to tell the difference between a pot-grown Christmas tree and one that's been dug up from the ground and put into a pot, and they're called container grown or potted, respectively. Potted trees are best avoided. They would have had a lot of damage to their roots when the tree's being dug up, and they're very unlikely to survive on planting the garden in the spring. So look for container grown, and if you're not sure, just ask the retailer, or just lift it out of its pot yourself, and you'll see that the tree's got a root ball on it. And also, when it comes to planting the tree, if it's been indoors for a few weeks, it's going to start thinking it's spring, because it's going to be nice and warm inside the house. And it might even start to grow, which is quite exciting, really, to see your Christmas tree growing in the house. But that new growth is quite sensitive to frost. So if you were to plonk it out on the doorstep come Boxing Day, and it's a very, very cold day or a cold night, the tree is probably going to go into shock. And all those lovely new shoots of growth will probably just drop off. So if you are moving your living Christmas tree outside, the best thing to do is just acclimatise it like you would with young plants. So harden them off gradually, maybe put them in a conservatory or a greenhouse, and as the weather warms up, then you can put the Christmas tree back outside. My Christmas tree this year, it could be anything, because I let my children decide, and they're quite random. So we'll have to wait and see what they choose. It's certainly going to be a chaotic beauty.
Well, that's all we've got time for in today's podcast. We'll be back with more sounds from the garden next month, when we'll be looking forward to 2020. Can you believe it? We're talking about that already. Until then, though, from me, Chris Young, and all the team, goodbye.